From the Sky News Centre at 5, the World Cup has begun in spectacular fashion. Hundreds of dancers filled the Soccer City Stadium with the colours of the African continent. The opening ceremony and the first match has been accompanied by the sound of thousands of vuvuzela trumpets. The host South Africa drew 1-1 with Mexico in their Group A game. There was a notable absence, though. The former South African president, Nelson Mandela, was too distressed to attend following the death of his great-granddaughter in a car crash. Solo Hatang from the Mandela Foundation says the family is devastated.
We're pleading with all South Africans and the world to actually just give the family the benefit of just grieving their loss of a family member in his family. So we'd like all of us to please understand that.
Meanwhile, officials are considering a minute's silence at England's first match tomorrow. It will be a tribute to the three British students killed in a bus crash in South Africa yesterday. BP could be looking at an eventual cost for clearing up the Gulf of Mexico oil spill of $6 billion. An oil industry analyst also says compensation to those affected by the leak could run to another $14 billion. The row continues over whether Barack Obama's anti-British language has been affecting BP's share prices. US commentator Charlie Wolf doesn't think that the president's handled it very well.
It is a crisis, and a crisis that needs to be addressed. And we're showing that all that Mr. Obama knows how to do, as he's done in the past, is blame somebody else. In this case, let's throw BP, or as he's calling it, British Petroleum, under the bus.
The former UN weapons inspector Hans Blix is to be questioned by the inquiry into the Iraq war. Former Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott is also on a list of 35 witnesses due to be called during a fresh round of hearings. And in tennis, Rafa Nadal has followed Andy Murray out of Queens this afternoon. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk.
If drink is costing you more than money, then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year,
by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory.
www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, re-elected last month back onto the City Council, and his name is Derek Pickup. We'll be having a close look at the city's provision of care for the elderly. And after the 6 o'clock news, the banksters have run off with £700 billion of Treasury bailout money, and the Chancellor tells us there's not enough left for public services now. The power to regulate the city is also gone from the industry-funded Financial Services Authority, the FSA, to the industry-funded private bank, the Bank of England. As the City of London completes another political coup, we dare to ask, should we nationalise the Cashpoint network, which is currently owned by private banks for profit, and bring them back into public control? Bob Wellham from the UK Money Reform Party will be here after the 6 o'clock news. Plus, we'll be asking Martin and Bob to pick apart David Cameron's speech earlier this week explaining the cuts. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but here's our, first of all, our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, averaging 17 degrees Celsius and fairly dry. Weekend, sunnier though on Saturday. Averaging 16 degrees Celsius next week, fairly dry week with some sunny spells. Rain though at the beginning of the week. Next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of June, averaging 17 degrees Celsius in the daytime. That's sunny and dry next weekend, the 19th and 20th of June. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, time to reduce this, introduce, in fact, this week's guests now. And with me is Councillor for Hartcliffe, who was re-elected back onto the City Council last month, Derek Pickup. Hello, Derek, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good afternoon, Tony.
So, you were voted out and now you've bounced back. How did you manage that?
Well, I think I was voted out because of the backlash against the government. That was 12 months ago. And I think I came back because I think people recognised that there's a need for a Labour government, and the area that I stood was an area that's strongly traditional Labour, and they wanted a Labour councillor to represent them.
Now that's Hartcliffe. You were standing in Hartcliffe before and this time, were you?
No. Previously I was a Labour councillor in Henbury on the other side of the city.
So is it you've been shifted over to Hartcliffe now to give you a better chance of getting in, is that right?
Well, I decided the shift because I think one of the things about being a councillor, if you put your heart and soul into doing a job, which I feel that I did, and then the local people decide that they want somebody else, regardless of how much effort you put in, I feel it's time then to move on to somewhere where they will appreciate the efforts you make. But we all know that in politics, often at a local level, what's happening at a national level will affect the way people vote.
Okay, now, what was your job? Because you were in the old Labour cabinet, weren't you?
I was in the old Labour cabinet, and I was at one time the executive member for Children's Services, and I followed that by being the executive member for Adult Social Care.
And what about the cabinet system? Because, as you were telling me before we started today, you were a council officer before the whole cabinet system started about 7 or 8 years ago. Can you tell us whether you think it's working for the public?
Well, I've been involved in local government for about 25 years, over 20 years as an officer and 4 years as a councillor. And there's been huge changes. I mean, previously we had the committee system, where now you have one cabinet member who has overall control of a particular area of the authority. So, for example, we have a cabinet member responsible for children's services, and that cabinet member takes all responsibility for that area of work, and they're scrutinised by a scrutiny committee. But the decisions are basically theirs and theirs alone, with the advice of officers. Now, previously, where you had the committee system that a lot of people like, you had councillors from all the political parties sitting on a committee. They were all able to have an input before decisions were made by the committee. So it was a much more of a collective approach. However, in Bristol, under the cabinet system, what each of the administrations has decided is that there should be a sort of cabinet-style responsibility. And the key decisions for each of the areas of the authority, each of the service areas, are taken at the cabinet meeting and not at separate meetings for each area. So each of the cabinet members doesn't have a separate meeting just looking at their own work. Everything is discussed at cabinet.
Are those cabinet meetings open to the public as well, then?
The cabinet meetings are open to the public, and in fact a lot of people do make statements to the meetings, and you are allowed to make statements, you're allowed to present petitions. What you're not allowed to is actually question the members of cabinet when they're discussing the particular items.
And what about the scrutiny process? How does that work?
Well, I think it's how the scrutiny process is supposed to work. The scrutiny process is supposed to do two things. It's supposed to look at the decisions that the cabinet have made and to look at the areas they're looking at, look at the things behind the decisions and decide whether the decisions, if you like, were reasonable. They also look at things that are likely to come up, the issues for the future, and if you like, give a view before the cabinet actually look at them. I think one of the big problems we've got in Bristol at the moment is the idea is that with a scrutiny commission, that the scrutiny commissions are chaired by the opposition parties. If you look now, an awful lot of the scrutiny commissions are chaired by the ruling group, because they've got a majority, they're able to vote their people to chair the scrutiny commissions as well as being on the cabinet. And I don't feel that that's good for democracy.
OK, now put your cards on the table. Is the cabinet system better than the old committee system?
I don't think that you can say one is better than the other.
Oh, that's
just different.
OK. Now, we're also joined by Martin Summers, our old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, we're going to be looking quite a lot at the money system in the second half. Who did the Treasury owe the debt and the interest on the debt that we'll be talking about in the second half and that David Cameron's been talking about this week too? Is it the bankers? Because the bankers owe us hundreds of billions for bailing them out.
Well, basically, the basic fact is that they owe it to the people who hold US Treasury bonds. And they can be a variety of different institutions and individuals, but banks are prominent in the list of people who hold those bonds.
Because it's a little bit confusing, isn't it? Because we, apparently, if you can imagine two sort of giant institutions, one is the government and the other is the banks. The banks owe the government money and the government owes the banks money. So couldn't it be just sort of, one cancel out the other?
Well, there's a very interesting, as we're going to discuss this in the second hour, but effectively, I mean, banks are buying back from the government government bonds, which is, forcing up the deficit, and it is, in fact, the banks that the deficit has been created by bailing out the banks. This is not fair. Something's got to be done about it, and we'll no doubt be discussing it more thoroughly in the second hour. But the idea that cuts should be made in frontline services to pay for this is A, unfair and immoral, but B, it will also crash the economy, so it's pretty stupid as well.
Okay, thanks. Just as a reminder for everyone, this is to do with the parliamentary and local elections in 2010. Bristol City Council are looking into any concerns that people have about the elections at the beginning of last month. They're collecting feedback from voters until the 18th of June. So if you had any problems or difficulties with voting, please be sure to let your local councillor know what happened and tell the council your story. You can do that by completing the Bristol City Council online election monitoring form, which is linked to from the front page of the Bristol City Council website. Findings will be published on the Bristol City Council website by the end of July. But if you're not on the internet, please contact the Chief Executive's office at Bristol City Council. The number for that, I think the lines are open between 9 and 4 weekdays, is 0117 922 2000. Now, I'm joined by Neil Evans. Neil, hi and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Nice to be here.
Neil, you've got a report on old people's homes for us this week.
Yes, I have. And it's not exactly what you call good news. Essentially, Bristol City Council have announced that the proposed shake-up of elderly care homes in the city has now been halted and have announced a review of its plans. And this review will take up to 4 months to complete.
I think this was at a cabinet meeting yesterday.
That's right, yes. In fact, it went through scrutiny that you were just talking about the day before, and it went then through the cabinet meeting yesterday. And the announcement by the ruling Liberal Democrat group now throws into doubt the whole strategy of replacing the city's existing 13 residential care homes, replacing them with 3 dedicated dementia homes and 4 what they call resource centres, and that's places with both permanent and temporary beds based on the level of need of the individual residents. Now, this project was called the Residential Futures Project and was originally agreed under the previous Labour administration back in 2008. Initially, there was broad, largely cross-party support for these proposals back then, but this consensus now appears to be rapidly dissolving, and one of Derek's colleagues, Jenny Smith, yesterday was quoted as saying that halting the work was the, and I'm quoting her here, the thin end of the wedge towards privatising the entire service. Now, the reason that Residential Futures Project was devised in the first place was partly because central government required local authorities to meet certain national standards of care as outlined in the previous Labour government's National Dementia Strategy and Transforming Social Care. And the key objective of this project was, and I'm quoting from the document here, to create a new vision of residential services for older people in Bristol and improve the council's ability to meet the needs and expressed preferences of older people and address the predicted increase in the numbers of older people in Bristol who are diagnosed with dementia over the next 15 to 20 years. Monitoring the effectiveness of Bristol's care for the elderly is a body called the Care Quality Commission, the CQC, and they're the government body responsible for ensuring high standards of social care in England. And the CQC, whilst they're happy with the levels of care that the staff are providing in these homes, they did highlight that many of the buildings were, if you like, struggling to be fit for purpose for the future. So for example, the lack of ensuite bathrooms for residents was obviously a concern. And it was against this backdrop that the Residential Futures Policy was devised as the best way forward for the council's delivery of care. Now, that said, many might ask, why was it necessary for the City Council to finance these changes purely through the sale of land, through the sale of the old care homes to finance, to self-finance, the new homes? And why hasn't the council guaranteed to underwrite the cost of seeing this project through to its conclusion? Obviously, only the politicians can only answer that. I spoke to John Rogers, who is in charge, the Liberal Democrat member, who's in charge of the council's health and social care department. And he defended the council's decision by telling me that the council could not have predicted the extent of the shortfall through the selling of the current sites, set against the costs of building new homes. The council claims that the annual cost of borrowing the £10.1 million needed, and that's the shortfall, that's the key figure here, would have cost an additional £750,000, presumably in interest in terms of borrowing the money. There would also have been additional staffing costs of £850,000 for the three dementia homes, money that would have to be found from savings made elsewhere. Now, whilst Councillor Rogers has apologised for the uncertainty this decision is bound to cause, the Labour opposition on the City Council has accused the Lib Dems of, and I'm quoting Derek here because I had a chat with him yesterday, of muddle and prevarication. I think I'm quoting you accurately on this issue. Effectively, the issue of care for Bristol's most vulnerable people is in serious danger of becoming a political football here, and I don't think anyone really wants to see that. So, where does that leave us now, I guess people would be asking. Well, the current proposals to close the two existing care homes this year will go ahead, and those homes are at Gleeson House in Fishponds and Birchwood in the St Anne's area of the city. The residents affected by these closures, about 70 people, will transfer to a new purpose-built home, Vetchley, in Redfield, which is currently under construction later this year. All other plans to close the remaining care homes and to find a site for a third specific dementia care home in the city have been paused, to quote Councillor Rogers, pending the outcome of the review. Now, of course, there may well be more uncomfortable questions for the council to answer following this review, particularly if the whole Residential Futures Initiative is scrapped. And that's essentially where we are, Tony.
Thanks very much, Neil. Derek, can you tell us how you were involved with this residential, or how you have been involved in this Residential Futures project? Because I think it's one of the issues across the city that many people are concerned about, whether or not they have their own relatives in any of these council-run care homes. So, yes, what was your involvement in putting it together?
My involvement was in 2008 when Residential Futures was agreed. I was the executive member who was responsible for adults. Social services. So it was during my tenure of office that we decided that this would be the strategy we would use to improve the services that we delivered to old people in the city. We know that we've got an elderly population that's growing. We know that the standard of care that we've offered through the City Council has not been as high as it should be. We know that the reports from the Care Quality Commission have not been the best. If you look at our homes, a lot of them are outdated. The room sizes are very small. They don't have on-site facilities. They have not been designed for the 20th century. We're 50 years behind where they should be. Now, in Bristol, we're very lucky that we've got people like Monica Wills Charity in the voluntary sector that actually provides some of the best care facilities for older people in the world. And in fact, their new dementia centre that they opened in the last year near Weston-super-Mare is regarded as the best in Europe. So it's not that there aren't examples there that the city council can look at in terms of where we should be going. And there's also a shift in what older people are looking for. There's a shift in the quality that they're looking for their old age. There's a shift in the quality that families feel is acceptable. There's also a shift in where people want to go, where they want to spend their old age. They don't all want to spend their time in elderly persons' homes. A lot of them want to stay in their own home. And part of the whole strategy of improving adult social care was also to improve the ability of the City Council to help individual older people to stay in their own homes. So what we wanted to do through the reorganisation was improve the residential facilities we had, make sure that there was a spread of support across the city. Secondly, to have resource centres that enabled people who had perhaps reached the stage where they'd gone into hospital, they'd had major health problems, they were coming out of hospital, they weren't ready to go back into their own home, but they didn't want to move into residential care. So the resource centre was a stopgap measure where we could help to support them and get them ready to move back into their own homes. And people, older people and their families, were very much in favour of that. Now, I think it's wrong to say that adult social care is just becoming a political football now. 3 years ago, the Liberal Democrat administration was kicked out of office because they tried to privatise home care. And it was the home care workers supporting the Labour Party that helped the Labour Party at that time take back power in Bristol City Council. And it was very much the people who were receiving services from the City Council in terms of support. It was the care workers themselves. It was the families of those who were receiving support who very much backed what the City Council wanted to do in terms of improve services. Now, the people who lose out at every stage of this is the people who are currently living in our homes. They went through a big period of uncertainty when we didn't know what was going to happen with home care, whether it was going to be privatised. They went through a huge consultation period in terms of finding out how residential futures would pan out, what exactly would happen to them, what homes would close, which ones would be refurbished, where we would have new homes. We went through a huge consultation exercise, and the biggest problem was those who are already in the system are those that it hits most, because those are the ones who are moved from pillar to post. And we promised those people that this time they would have one move, and that was the last move that would be forced upon them. And that was a commitment that we made as a council. All political parties were behind that. As was said before, the scrutiny process supported that, the cabinet supported that. And now the Liberal Democrats have come back and said, no, all on hold. Everything is now in the melting pot. Insecurity for those people. They don't know if they'll be able to stay where they are, whether they'll move. They've no idea again what's going to happen. One of the most vulnerable groups in society are being hung out to dry again.
Well, I imagine if Councillor Rogers was here or others from the Liberal Party, they would say to you, well, they've had a close look at these plans and decided that they're just not viable.
Well, I wonder why the Liberal Democrat administration last year overspent on adult social services by over £4 million and why in the current financial year they increased the budget by over £4 million. If you add that together and they tried to keep the budget, balance it, as the Labour administration had done before, they'd have had £8 million towards the £10 million that they needed to actually enact the residential futures.
I was just thinking, wonder if I could come back with a question. I mean, was it somewhat short-sighted on the part of all politicians concerned to base this whole residential futures policy on being self-financing, given that property values were already falling in 2008. The likelihood of getting a return on the old buildings to pay for the new buildings was obviously not there. Now the Labour administration surely would have seen that come in, and certainly the current administration, if there was somebody from representing them, such as Councillor Rogers here today, I'd be asking him that very question. Surely this is a failure of politics in Bristol, as opposed to the fault of one party or another. And as you rightly say, the people who lose out are the staff, the residents and their families.
The Labour Cabinet had looked at this 2 years ago, when we were looking at what was happening with residential futures. In terms of the positions of the market conditions at that time, it was anticipated that the sale of homes would make it self-financing. However, as time went on, we realised that there was likely to be a shortfall, and John Bees, who was responsible for resources under the Labour Cabinet, had already been looking at where he could find the money to fill those gaps. So Labour had been committed to follow this through and would have found the resources.
So you'd have underwritten the costs that the shortfall, basically.
We'd have found
such as it was then.
We'd have found the shortfall. We had promised that we would, and we would have found it. In politics, it's always the situation that you want to do more than you have resources available. So you always have to prioritise. You know, in Bristol, you've seen us prioritise, for example, in education. This was a priority in terms of older people. We'd said we were going to do it. We would have followed through if we were still the cabinet.
Or the World Cup bid. I mean, there's money going into supporting a bid which is at no guarantee of success, for which the main beneficiaries are Bristol City Football Club and its supporters. I have to ask the question, has the council of whatever political hue got the right sense of priorities here?
Well, I mean, the cabinet have always got to balance the different demands, and the cabinet are the ones who make the decisions about where they feel they should focus the money. And certainly in the current economic climate, we're being told that there's going to be less resources, and we have to be very careful where funding is spent. And we have to ensure, I think, as politicians, that those who are most vulnerable within the system are not the ones who receive the cuts.
Now, Derek, can you just, because I think your day job is involved in the area of care of some sort, isn't it? Am I right?
Well, I work with children and young people, and in fact, half of my job is working with schools, and half my job is working for the Kingswood Foundation, that provides a whole range of different facilities, particularly in terms of the arts, to young people across Bristol and South Gloucestershire.
Well, what is the Kingswood Foundation? Tell us a bit more about it.
The Kingswood Foundation was started in the 1970s to provide support for children and young people. It started more as a sort of care regime and has moved more to an organisation that focuses on developing young people, the sort of 11 to 19 age group principally. And we provide a whole range of different services, and we're lucky that we've got a 9-acre base, 70,000 square feet of buildings. We follow on from the a site that was originally developed by Wesley in the 1700s. We follow from a tradition of providing support to young people. The site we're on was, at one stage, for example, was a care home for young people. So I'm certainly involved in providing to some of the services to vulnerable groups in the city. And in fact, at the Kingswood Foundation, we also rent out space to other groups. And one of the groups we rent out space is to the Alzheimer's Society. They've got a day centre called the Limes, dealing with Alzheimer patients.
Now, Martin, let me bring you on this, Martin Summers. Is all this really kind of to do with the demographic time bomb? And it's the fact that people are living longer and longer and longer. There simply isn't enough money left in the pot to look after them like they used to be.
Well, it's clearly a question of resources. I mean, Derek was talking about people's expectations being higher. They live longer, they've got higher expectations of a quality of life. I mean, people used to finish working at, in factories when they were 65 and they were dead by the time they were 70, and that's no longer the case. But nevertheless, it is a question of resources on a global and national scale. And it's very difficult for politicians at local level to buck the trend of what's happening in the national economy and national policy. So, you know, there's a limited scope for manoeuvre there, whoever's in charge of Bristol City Council. There are bigger sort of macroeconomic issues that have to be tackled. And to my mind, the idea that you can't look after your own people is arsy-versy. You've got to look after your own people first and then think about fighting foreign wars, etc., you know.
Yeah, so Derek, the demographic issue. Surely what we're trying to do here is to look after people for longer and longer and longer as people are living longer, and it's just not possible on the old resources and on the old budgets.
I think if you look around somewhere like Bristol, the mixture of provision is probably better now than it's ever been. If you look at the quality of provision, it's better than it's ever been. So I think it's wrong to say that certainly at the current time, I don't believe there are less resources going into this area. It's true that there aren't as much resource as we want, but certainly as yet they haven't reduced. I don't think they have reduced at the moment. I think we're moving into a time where they possibly are going to reduce, but at the moment I don't think they have reduced. And I think in Bristol we have some very good services available. If we look across the board about what's being provided by the government, what's being provided by the private sector, and what's being provided by the charitable sector, in Bristol we're actually quite well provided compared to other areas of the country.
Okay, Martin, what about the future? Do you think that there can be continued problems with elderly care because of this? I'm keeping on this demographic issue because, as far as I can see, if we've got more and more elderly people living longer and longer, this problem is not going to go away.
Well, a problem is also a solution. They're going to need to be cared for, aren't they? And then you can provide jobs caring for them. And we've got plenty of people who need jobs. So it's a question of priorities and values of the society as a whole. We're a much wealthier society than we were 50 years ago. Much wealthier, but a lot of that money is wasted on silly things, and we've just got to get our priorities right.
Derek, what was the effect on the elderly people, particularly those living in the homes around the city at the moment, of this decision yesterday to have another review?
Well, people become very, very worried. They've got no idea what's going to happen to them. They went through a review a couple of years ago where they were made a cast iron promise about what would happen, and suddenly they found 2 years later, in the middle of implementing a policy, that it stopped, and they don't know where they are. So suddenly they're frightened. They don't know what's going to happen to them. They feel that they've got no power or influence over the process. Families get very angry. The older people don't really get a chance to get angry.
Do you have any evidence of families actually really getting angry? I mean,
well, if you go to any of the meetings that are called, if you go to a meeting that's held in one of the elderly care homes where the families are invited to say what they think, then you'll see angry people.
Okay, so if you were in charge now, and or you know, you had the influence to decide what to do, what would you do?
I would find the money.
Where from?
Well, I mean, there's two things. One, you have to be in power to know exactly where the pockets of money are and what you can use.
Because we're being told this week by the central government they're giving even less money. They're cutting back the budget coming from central government to Bristol this week.
Yes, but I mean, as local governments, like everything else, there's always more to do than you've got money. So you have to relook at your programme of capital expenditure. You've got to relook at your revenue expenditure. You have to prioritise. If you've got to find the money to make this happen, then you find the money.
Okay, Derek, well, it's 5:30 now. Time to take a break from our look at the elderly people's care home. We'll have the news review in a minute. And we're going to listen now, though, to our guest Derek Pickup's choice of music. Derek, I'm going to get you to introduce it. What's the song and why did you choose it?
Well, I've chose Yesterday by the Beatles. I think all of us, I'm now, like a lot of councillors, would be described as a middle-aged white male. And if I look back to my youth, from the age of 2 to 12, I lived in Liverpool. And so the rise of the Beatles was very much a part of my life as a young person. And I think you always look back to the best parts of your life when you were young, fit, healthy, growing up as a child. So it sort of reminds you of those times.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Yesterday by the Beatles, chosen by today's guest on BCFM 93.2's Friday Drive Time, Derek Pickup, who's Labour councillor for Hartcliffe. Now, let's get on to our review of the week's news, and we'll start with another story. Well, this is a national news story to do with care home residents, and we're told by the Daily Mail this week that there's a warning of capital gains tax risk to 150,000 residents of care homes across the country. So what does this mean, Derek? What is this capital gains tax, and why are so many elderly people gives them something else to worry about, this, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does if the reports are true. I mean, David Cameron said it will be clarified in the forthcoming budget, but at the moment, the way that we're being told it's going to happen, it's going to affect everybody, whether you're a billionaire or whether you're somebody who's, you know, just got their family home.
Well, the report's saying is that the elderly people could be penalised by capital gains tax bills because their former family home could be treated as their second home.
It's outrageous, I think, and I think it's somebody devising a policy without very carefully looking at its effects on people. And there's been a long battle by people not to have their homes, which they've spent their whole lives saving for, taken away from them. And you've now got a situation where it's coming back again, that unless this is changed, if they've been in care for more than, I think it's 2 years, and their house is sold, they could pay up to 50% capital gains tax. And that's absolutely outrageous.
Martin?
I agree that it's outrageous and problematic for this particular group, but I think capital gains tax as a whole needs to be looked at properly. We've got a situation where people don't pay capital gains tax on their homes. Now, that actually creates enormous macroeconomic distortions in our economy. It means that money gets sucked into property when it ought to be invested in other things. Everybody gets obsessed with this idea of owning their own home, and it creates big distortions in our economy, which is one of the reasons why we can't compete in the world economy.
But Martin, you call it an obsession. Isn't it a totally natural thing to want to own your own home?
Yes, but why you shouldn't necessarily get a tax break to do it. If you're wealthy enough to buy your own home without a tax break, well, fair enough. But if you've got a tax break, that means that people are more likely to put their money into bricks and mortar than into other things. And that leads, for example, when we're competing with France and Germany, that their investment goes into businesses, our investment goes into conservatories. But that's why we can't keep up.
But I'm sure the government, the Treasury, etc., would be saying, look, we've got to make these cuts somewhere and we've got to get more tax from somewhere.
I think that this particular group requires to be looked at very carefully. I agree with Derek about this. It's unfair for them to be singled out in this way. They're a particularly vulnerable group. Special dispensation needs to be made. But I think we've really got to look at the whole way we run our economy over the last 30 or 40 years. This encouragement of home ownership, the selling off of the council stock of houses, all the rest of it has actually created the mess we are in. That is why we are in a mess. Now, we've got to be honest with ourselves and say we're in a mess because we've had this obsession with home ownership for political reasons. It was originally, this capital gains tax was taken off home ownership in the 1920s by the Conservatives to encourage conservatism in the working class. That was the whole idea behind it. And of course, we've never had the courage to deal with the vested interests behind all of this, the estate agents and so on and so forth. But they are a drag on our economy and something's going to have to be done about it. This is an emergency. It's time to look at all the options.
You're so biased, Martin, saying that there's an obsession with owning your own home, because this is something that surely everybody, almost everybody, aspires to do this in
not
a perfectly
in Germany.
Normal way.
Not in France
are you
and Germany.
Are you saying that it's wrong to want to own your own home?
No, it's not wrong, but it's not a choice that should be encouraged by public subsidy.
Yeah, I mean, I think Martin's right that there is a problem here. I mean, I can remember when we bought our first home, and it was three times my salary. If my daughter now wants to buy a home, it would be something like six times her joint salary with her husband. And people are put into a situation now where they can't afford to buy their own home. If we had a reasonable rented sector and people were not pushed into feeling that they had to buy their own home, then I don't think people would feel that was something they had to do. If they can have a reasonable home in a place where they want to live, then why should they be stuck with paying these huge amounts of money just to acquire a home? I mean, the percentage of people's income that's going into paying for mortgages is astronomical, and what it means is they have to cut back on all other things. And I think if we could come to a reasonable compromise where in fact we had more people who felt that they could rent and weren't pressurised into buying, you know, there would be more money in the economy, as Martin said, for other more important things.
Well, the good news is that the Prime Minister's reiterated that the case for raising capital gains tax, but he's insisted that the concerns of critics, like your good selves here, will be addressed in the emergency budget, which is going to come out later this month.
Can I just say, I think it's quite commendable that the Tories are prepared to raise capital gains tax. I mean, I'm not particularly supportive of their regime, as it were, but I mean, at least they're prepared to actually look at it, and that's very good and commendable.
Now, is capital gains tax something that's levied on any kind of?
If you own some shares and they go up in value, you make a windfall profit. Some of that money should go back to society because you haven't actually done anything to deserve it, have you? It's a windfall profit.
Okay, our next story. The government's telling Bristol City Council, as we said a little earlier on, to slash costs to help tackle the nation's debt. That was in the Evening Post, I think today, in fact. Almost £7 million is being axed from council funding in the Bristol area as the government demands immediate cuts to help tackle the nation's debt. Community Secretary Eric Pickles has ordered Bristol City Council to hand back £3.1 million from this year's budget. Derek.
Well, obviously, it means that the local authority is going to have to relook at its budget for the year and find the savings from the money it's got. It'll either have to you know, it could be a mixture of taking money from reserves and partly from their current spending budget for this year.
This isn't normal, though, is it, for a council to have set a budget, made a budget, be spending the budget, and then suddenly have to say, oh, hang on a minute, that's
no,
all changed.
I've never known it happen before. This is highly unusual. Bristol have been quite lucky that they'd got quite a good settlement for this year's budget. They'd passed the budget at the annual general meeting, and now, you know, things will be very chaotic because they've got to relook at the entire budget because of this sort of immediate cut. It means that we haven't been able to plan for it, and, you know, there will obviously be problems in implementing it.
The councils have also apparently around the country been warned not to sink any more money into major projects such as Bristol's £48 million Bendy bus scheme until they know if they have any chance of being given government funding. Martin, what are your thoughts on this announcement today?
Well, obviously it can't be solved at the micro level of the council. I mean, the amount of money that's made available to Bristol is the amount of money that's made available to Bristol, and therefore the priorities within that have to be decided politically. But we also have to think about nationally what our priorities are. I don't see that there is any sense at all in cutting public expenditure at this moment. We do need to deal with the deficit, and the logical way to deal with that is to take money from those who have benefited from the 30 years of bubble economy that we've had under the Conservatives and New Labour.
But I'm afraid, Martin, and that's all just hot air, isn't it? Because this is what has been decided in a general election.
No, well, I would actually dispute the mandate behind this. The Conservatives have 37% of the vote. They've cobbled something together with the Liberal Democrats, who didn't promise any of this in their election campaign. So they're completely overthrowing their election promises. Of course, they're all getting away with it because our own Labour leadership promised that they would cut, with a nod and a wink to us, saying that we're not going to cut now. We should have been stronger and clearer about what the national priorities are. At the end of the day, it's actually national suicide to cut public expenditure at this moment. As we will see, it's not just a question of unfairness. The economy will tank, and you won't even cut the deficit because the tax receipts will go down, your welfare payments of unemployment and so on will go up. This is exactly what happened in the 1980s during the glorious Thatcher era. They're just about to repeat all of those mistakes. Just wrong, wrong, wrong. Now, if there's a problem with the deficit, some people started off as millionaires 30 years ago before the city was city's big bang. They're now billionaires. It's time for them to get their chequebooks out. It's a national emergency.
Well, I'm afraid that was all very well, but at least one of them has gone to the Channel Islands, hasn't he?
Well, what I say about that, if I've just finished with that, perhaps let Derek in, is I would pass a law saying that all British citizens must pay all relevant UK taxes or lose their citizenship. That means you can go to the Channel Islands, but you can't come back.
I mean, if you look back to times when there's been financial strife in the past, if you look back to the 1920s, countries like Holland started massive public projects to actually bring people into work, so that even if they weren't earning a lot of money, they were working rather than living on benefits. You're talking about a system whereby they're going to cut all this money. By cutting the money, they're going to cut jobs. By cutting jobs, they're going to be cutting incomes. And the economy is going to spiral downwards. It's not going to help. It wasn't the ordinary people in Britain who lost us all this money, but it's the ordinary people are now being targeted to take the pain. And as Martin was saying, it is wrong. There is always another way.
Now, just as if to re-emphasise the cost-cutting agenda, the UK coalition government must cut its budget deficit, which is the Fitch ratings agency is warning, and they must cut it faster. This is a story from The Guardian on Tuesday this week. Martin, who are these Fitch ratings agency,
these are the people who rated all of this subprime junk as AAA and have now decided that we've got to cut our deficit.
What is a ratings agency?
They are private agencies who are essentially an oligopoly. There's only three of them, and they don't in fact undercut each other, and they basically decide what things are supposedly worth. But they got it spectacularly wrong in the run up to this crash. It's surprising that anybody takes any notice of them. Other more serious economists in the city are predicting that the economy will crash as a result of cutting public expenditure, and they're saying that we shouldn't do it. And these are people who push money around for a living. I think we're still in the grip of a kind of ideological ice space age. People still haven't got their heads around the idea that, that the way we used to run things for the last 30 years was wrong, all wrong. And they're still just coming out with the same old stuff. And of course, this is what the people who hold government debt want to hear. They want their money back. But somebody's going to have to take a hit.
Now, if the government,
have to be them.
If the government ignores the markets, Martin, it does that at its peril, doesn't it? Because then it's going to probably come a cropper in the,
well,
in the
no,
years
what,
to come.
What, there's these same people will be saying, well, we're going to have to raise taxes on property and wealth then in order to cover the deficit. And they say, oh, no, you can't do that. Because they're the people with property and wealth. I mean, the behind the markets stand the wealthy classes who invest in those markets. So at the end of the day, these are the kind of things that would have been robustly discussed in the 1950s about who was going to pay for the crisis. And the Labour Party in government would have just said, no, you're going to have to pay, get your chequebooks out. And we've just lost that kind of language, and we've just got to get back to it, because that's what it's really all about.
Do you want the final word on this, Derek?
Yeah, I mean, I think Martin's right. We're in a situation where the government has to show the way that the country's moving. And I think that we have to move in a situation where you've got to keep people in work. Work and having an income is what drives the country forward. And if you take that away from people, that's what's going to put the economy in the spiral, into a downward spiral. So the government should be trying to make sure that everybody retains work, and we carry on and we pay back this money as and when we can, but we keep people in work. And it's wrong to say the only way we can do it is by slashing funding, slashing jobs, and targeting the most vulnerable people there are.
Now I'm joined by Marina Morris. Marina, you're talking about mental health issues today.
Yes. The government's agenda is cuts. It's time to value the spending power of money and to target it towards the maximum benefits. In these Austrian times, according to the BBC News, in England, mental health issues cost £77 billion a year. Poor mental health affects 16.7 million people in the UK today. In last week's Scrubbing Up, a magazine and website for medical students, clinical psychologist Professor T. Wicks says strategies for funding researchers into mental health need to be overhauled. Patients and their family deserve better. Mental illness are still too often ignored or misunderstood. On one side, only 5% of medical research in the UK is into mental health, despite 15% of disability resulting from disease being due to mental illness. On the other side, teaching people about good mental health can give benefits. Educating school children about their emotional well-being could prevent many youngsters from suffering mental health problems in later life. It's estimated that 1 in 4 of the UK citizens, 15 million people of all ages, will experience a mental health problem this year. That's substantially more people than will have a heart attack or stroke, and yet twice as much research goes into heart disease and stroke than it's carried out in mental health. It's far more people than will be diagnosed with cancer this year, and yet cancer get more than 25% of medical research funding, 5 times as much as mental health. The world situation is no better. According to the World Health Organization, about half of mental disorders begin before age of 14. Around 20% of the world's children and teenagers are estimated to have mental disorder of problems, with similar types of disorder being reported across culture. Stigma about mental disorder are discrimination against patients and families prevent people from seeking mental health care. In South Africa, a public survey showed that most people thought mental illness were related to their stress or lack of willpower rather than medical disorders. Contrary to expectation, levels of stigma were higher in the urban areas and among people with high level of education. Conservative Party health policy promises outcomes, not targets. The asylums have long since closed, but the UK needs to maintain the pressure for the better care so people with mental health problems can lead productive, positive lives. We await a positive outcome to governmental policy.
Marina, thanks very much. Now, Derek, I mean, you must have seen quite a lot of changes in the way that local authorities deal with mental health. Do you think it's been for the better?
I think mental health is one of those areas that has never received the priority that it should, and that it's actually very difficult to seek proper diagnosis, and then once you've got proper diagnosis to get proper help. And I think, as was pointed out, this is really something about starting at quite a young age of trying to make sure that you look after not only the physical health of a person, that you look after the mental health, so that a lot of these the problems that people have in later life don't actually occur. And I don't think at the moment that we put enough effort into providing support for people who've got mental health problems. And it does mean that there's lots of people who've got problems that aren't being properly treated. It means that they can't work, they're unable to work, they go into a poverty trap. And I think it's about time that the government looked again at mental health strategy and put more resources in, not less, because I think in the end society's going to benefit hugely by increased investment, not cutting investment.
Well, it was back in the early 90s, wasn't it, that Virginia Bottomley, Conservative Health Secretary, introduced this whole care in the community concept, where people would be go into flats and things and out of mental homes. Do you think that was the right move?
I think the problem is it's getting the balance right of where people should be. And I think the problem is they probably tipped too far one way than the other, and what we need to do is really look at where do we get the balance right. And it's not only look at those who've got serious mental health disorders, you've also got to tackle those who've got less serious mental health disorders. So you've got to look at how you can tackle mental health at all levels.
Now, a couple of media stories. The Bristol Evening Post staff, I think this is either yesterday or today, scooped top prizes at the EDF Media Awards. Now, I'm a little bit worried about this, because EDF are planning to build, a nuclear power station at... and it seems like the Evening Post has got these awards from the same company that wants to build these, at least one anyway, of the nuclear power stations locally on the Bristol Channel. But actually, the real story at the moment is a much bigger one. It's to do with Press TV, which is the Iranian broadcasting in English channel. And we've got two quite interesting things this week, because we had the BBC, first of all, on Wednesday, news coming out that the BBC have been sabotaging Press TV's broadcasts. The British Broadcasting Corporation, apparently, employees of, have been showering Afghan cable networks with lucrative deals to cut broadcastings of Iran's English language news channel. Then the next day, we see Ofcom, who is investigating Iran's Press TV over an interview, and apparently this journalist has accused the Iranian channel Press TV of colluding in his wrongful imprisonment. Now, Martin, we've heard a lot about Afghanistan this week, particularly with the sanctions against Iran as well. It does seem like there's almost a kind of media war breaking out between Press TV, the Iranian channel, and the West.
Well, it's hard to say exactly what's going on, and we need more information, really. I mean, obviously, there are plenty of political agendas being pushed here, but we need to actually get more detail about this before we start jumping to radical conclusions about things.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I mean, I don't quite understand what's happening in Iran, and I think it's one of those areas of the world where before you jump to conclusions you have to try and gain more information about what's happening.
Well, what are your thoughts about the imposition of sanctions this week on Iran then by the United Nations, Derek?
It's very difficult because you've got to balance the fact that what effect sanctions have on the Iranian people in general.
Well, with Iraq, it's been the prelude to war, and also, other parts of the world.
And you've got to balance that with the fact that the Iranian government are not listening to anybody. They're shutting out what the rest of the world is saying and ploughing their own furrow. I think it's a highly dangerous situation that has to be watched very, very carefully.
Well, I think we've finally found something to disagree about, Derek. I don't think that. I mean, both Brazil and Turkey voted against these sanctions, and Lebanon abstained in the Security Council. And of course, if it went to the UN General Assembly, they would be kicked out. There is no evidence from the IAEA that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. That's completely. It's a bit like Iraqi WMD. There's no real evidence of this at all. A state in the Middle East does have nuclear weapons, and we know they have nuclear weapons. That state is Israel, and nobody's talking about that. If I was the Iranian General Staff, I'd want nuclear weapons. Nevertheless, there is no evidence that they are developing them. All they've got to do, apparently, if they were logical, is just leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as Israelis have done, and then they can develop nuclear weapons perfectly legally. Now, this whole thing is being pushed in the wrong direction.
Okay, Martin, thank you. Well, we're coming up to time for the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, who was re-elected last month back onto Bristol City Council, Derek Pickup. After the news, the banksters have run off with £700 billion of Treasury bailout money, which means, we're told, there's not enough left for public services. The power to regulate the city's gone this week, from the industry-funded Financial Services Authority, the FSA, to the industry-funded Private Bank of England. Plus, we'll be asking Martin to pick up a part David Cameron's speech earlier this week, explaining why we have to cut. Join us after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.